Chapter 10. What goes on in the Bible? The government of the United States is not in any sense founded on the Christian religion, President John Adams. From the advent of the first historical empires, over 10,000 years have elapsed. We have long attempted to answer the dilemma of evil and its permutations. We have been led to believe that it is a natural, if pernicious, part of life, something we each have to work out as we exist and evolve. We are made to think that evil comes into being because of the erstwhile movement of nature. We do not see the ramifications of this false contention. If we embody it, then we subliminally regard nature and its order as ontologically inferior. Nature is ignorant, we think. If it could bring about a propensity in its highest creation that undermines its own order, then, by implication, it cannot be intelligent or worthy of reverence and care. It is this attitude which then leads to the desecration of nature, animals, and indigenous peoples as well. The Druids did not permit themselves the luxury of cutting a single living thing with a sharpened edge. Compare this to today's savagery and carnage. In a sincere desire to discover the origins of evil and in a need to circumvent the drive, personally and collectively, we have turned to the philosophers and to the scientists and priests. For all their musings and pontification, the academic philosophers have come up relatively empty when providing clear understanding of this matter for all humanity. Science does not exalt the moral question to any intense degree. Scientists cannot even find consensus on the mysteries of the physical earth. Orthodox geologists have generally failed to account for anomalies pertaining to the origin of life, of the hominids, the later genus Homo, and the fossil record. The alumni of the earth sciences consciously manufactured the fallacious theory of the Ice Age and the Pleistocene epoch. They advocated uniformitarianism, stating what they knew to be untrue, that geological and evolutionary changes take place over extremely long periods of time and at very slow rates. The concept of the Ice Age does not come anywhere near to accounting for the paroxysms that occurred on the earth and are recorded in the legends of the native peoples. It was concocted to lead people astray from the realization of occurrences that not only shaped the earth but that impacted humans physiologically and psychologically. Moreover, the elitist world of science has brought its fury to bear on the lives, careers, and advancement of their detractors, genius mavericks, and revisionists, such as Emanuel Velikovsky, Ignatius Donnelly, and Commons Beaumont. Edmund Halley was the first scientist to account for the biblical deluge by polar displacement, when he first argued his case before the Royal Society of London in 1692. The revelation was so startling that his paper was not published until 30 years after. Larry Brian Radka, Astronomical Revelations. Those diligent scholars who have done their homework jettison the Ice Age theory as completely untenable. Since 1995, the science is improving that there was neither a Pleistocene epoch nor a long-lasting Ice Age of the type habitually advocated, see Appendix B. It is our belief that the hypotheses and theories promoted by the establishment scholars were always known to be inadequate and scientifically suspect, for it is far beyond the dictates of reason that Darwin, Wallace, Agassiz and Lyell, etc., could get their facts so wrong by mere accident. The reasons why things went so wrong is understood when it is realized how much was at stake for the establishment if scholars and the masses should ever connect the destruction on Earth with the coming of extraterrestrial entities. The descendants of these visitors are now in total charge of the Earth and obviously deem it essential that the history of the Earth, of its geospheric and topographical evolution, be made to appear the result of gradual changes and the effects of ice that descended upon the northern continents. It was of paramount importance that humans did not look back to the pre-diluvian epochs, for nothing is secret, that shall not be made manifest, neither anything hid, that shall not be known and come abroad, Luke 8:17. To get the word out, their opponents have had to resort to fiction and fantasy, to music and film, in which they tell the tale, knowing that it is unlikely that the average reader or viewer will go beyond their entertainment value, or indulge in deeper, heuristic analyses. Those of a questioning bent, disenchanted with the quandaries of materialistic science, frequently turn to religion. Its representatives have lauded themselves as having the question of evil in hand, as possessing the special abilities and knowledge, which alone address mankind's epistemological conundrums. For 2,000 years, Christianity and the major religions have sought to account for the presence of evil. They have not succeeded in giving us any clear answer. In attempting to answer one question, they have fostered thousands of new ones, and some might argue that along with science, religion is one of the most adroit exponents of evil in the world today. And indeed, when we review the canon of Christianity, we have good reason to feel frustrated. One may well ask, what is going on in the Bible? Let us then take a brief look. We are told by the religions that man has two natures, good and evil. One is then compelled to ask why God would instill such propensities in his own creations who are made in his image. We read that God created man and woman. This implies that God is not man nor woman himself. Yet, consistently, the post-diluvian religions all over the globe constantly depicted and referred to God as male. They do this even when, in the case of Hebrew, the name for deity is of feminine gender. We are told that man was not originally evil. He became that way after the disobedience of Eve in the garden. Why would God create something born in his image and then deny him some aspect of knowledge and then even banish him from paradise after it had been received? We must also ask why God would condemn his creations for something that was not a conscious transgression? Why the tests imposed on those who must already be innocent in nature? Then we are told that the parents sinned only after they fell under the influence of the evil one, Satan. So we ask, why would God allow his newly created beings to be in the proximity of this evil one who created the serpent? Nowhere in the Genesis account is there any mention, direct or indirect, of Satan's involvement, and yet it has become common practice for the church to portray the serpent as an emissary of Satan, or even as Satan himself, Lawrence Gardner. Why would God himself know evil, before man was even created, unless God had already brought evil into the world? Why, as we read in the book of Job, would God give Satan, a being that cannot be trusted, the right to test Job? Why would God not already know whether Job was a true servant or not? Is there a limit to the omnipresence of Jehovah? One cannot also conceive of the reason for the existence of any being, like Satan, who has no good in him at all. What would be the point of creating such a being, or in sending him to test those who themselves must be morally pure? If Satan could even have the ability to aspire toward supreme Godhead, and if there are hierarchies of angels, etc., then perhaps God can indeed be surpassed. What are we to make of this? We find that Jehovah told a lie. Eve did eat of the prohibited tree, but did not, as was warned, die. So how and why would a God that puts such currency in morality tell lies? God promised Noah after the flood that he would never visit the world with like calamity again, but there have been innumerable devastations unleashed on earth, which taken together would rival and even surpass the horror and death toll of a prehistoric eon. Why does God create mankind and then, lamenting his great evil nature, proceed to destroy all his creations? Why not confine the act to mankind alone? And would it not have been simpler to create man and, thereafter, not expose him to sin? If it is true, as the Bible declares and theologians state, that the sin involved Adam and Eve being made conscious of their nakedness, does this mean that God and the serpent and the others that were around were clothed? We read that Cain, after slaying Abel, is banished forever by the Lord, but is then endowed with the mark to prevent anyone from slaying him. But why would the Lord want Cain's life spared? How would anyone know Cain's past deeds and want to kill him? And how could any mark matter one way or another? Is there a mark that denotes that one has committed fratricide? And furthermore, who would be in the position to kill Cain, since he and his parents were, supposedly, the only beings alive in creation? We read that when Moses encounters Jehovah at the burning bush, God tells his prophet that he is the God of thy fathers. How can this be, and what does it mean? Moreover, why does Moses ask to know God's name, if the chosen people, the Israelites, already knew it? Among the many commandments that were levied by Jehovah was one categorically forbidding magical practices by any of the chosen. Why, in this case, were Moses and Aaron doing the rod and snake trick in front of the Pharaoh and his priests? Where did the exceptions begin and end? Why does Jehovah, who commissioned Moses to secure the freedom of the chosen people, then continually harden Pharaoh's heart to prevent their easy release? Does this not smack more of human politics? Why is it that we read of Jesus experiencing baptism from John? Why would the sinless Son of God need to go through a ritual that is reserved for the sinners seeking repentance and conversion? Jesus openly rebuked all public prayer. So why was this made the staple thing in later Christianity? There is no precedence for celibacy in the Bible, so why did this become vogue in Christianity? And what of the character of Jesus? We are told that he is the embodiment of love, compassion, and forgiveness, but we read of him turning over tables, talking about bringing a sword rather than peace, and stating in Luke, "But those mine enemies which would not that I reign over them, bring hither and slay before me," and regarding the mission, destiny, and message of Christ, why would God send his Son, a pure soul, into the so-called veil of death to rise again from that state back to the Godhead that he already once enjoyed? Was this necessary for the simple transmission of a spiritual message? What would be the purpose of such an exercise? What does it say about the omnipotence of the God of the Testaments? If paradise could be lost once and then regained, what is to prevent the scenario repeating ad infinitum? And what of the character of Yahweh, Jehovah? Is there not inconsistency there also? If he, Jehovah, is in reality the only God or the only real God, then why the constant remonstrations about worshipping other gods? What would Jehovah have to fear? Is it the free will of people that is remonstrated against? According to conventional interpretations, does he not banish Satan and human sinners to perpetual agony in hell? Satan could not be the creator of hell, for nowhere does it say that he was, and if he was, why would he stay in it? Is Jehovah not the creator of both evil and hell? Nowhere in the text does it state the contrary. And if God is good, why send any of his creations to everlasting perdition for any reason? Why not just destroy that entity, since, according to Genesis, this is what was done to the first creation? Surely, this would be less misery to the wretch. God condemns eternally and his mortal creations suffer interminably for the slightest moral deviation or infraction. So we ask, who is evil, the one who acts it out, or the one who created the propensity in the first place? Does it not seem strange that the God who promised to take care of all his people and never bring another deluge would be so conspicuously absent during all the subsequent horrors of history? So it goes on and on throughout the Bible text. No wonder that Pliny the Younger, when asked by the Emperor Trajan about Christianity, replied that it was a degenerate sort of cult taken to extravagant lengths. I do not believe in the creed professed by the Jewish Church, by the Roman Church, by the Greek Church, by the Turkish Church, by the Protestant Church, nor by any church that I know of. Each of those churches accused the other of unbelief, and for my own part, I disbelieve them all. Thomas Paine, I have examined all the known superstitions of the world, and I do not find in our particular superstition of Christianity one redeeming feature. They are all alike founded on fables and mythology. Millions of innocent men, women and children, since the introduction of Christianity, have been burned, tortured, fined and imprisoned. What has been the effect of this coercion? To make one half the world fools and the other half hypocrites, to support roguery and error all over the earth. Thomas Jefferson. The clergy converted the simple teachings of Jesus into an engine for enslaving mankind and adulterated by artificial constructions into a contrivance to filch wealth and power to themselves. These clergy, in fact, constitute the real anti-Christ. Thomas Jefferson. What influence, in fact, have Christian ecclesiastical establishments had on civil society? In many instances they have been upholding the thrones of political tyranny. In no instance have they been seen as the guardians of the liberties of the people. Rulers who wished to subvert the public liberty have found in the clergy convenient auxiliaries. A just government, instituted to secure and perpetuate liberty, does not need the clergy. President James Madison, thanks to scholars, we now know that the Book of Genesis is a simulacra of earlier Sumerian, Akkadian, and Egyptian originals, in which the experiences of the dramatis personae are suggestively similar. The net result is that the Christian hegemony has no answer for the existential predicaments of man. In fact, they have made these worse. They espouse no answers or remedies that do not themselves foster the repression of the natural instincts. Surely, after 2,000 years of such labyrinth and diversions, theological nonsense, and prevarication, it is time to hand out the pink slip to the representatives of religion and pay no more mind to their hyperbole. One would think that this leaves humankind in a void when it comes to the question of evil and its exact origins and denouement, but it does not. As I have shown, the ancients had more than enough to say about the coming of evil into the human arena. Behind the veneer of fairy folklore, of myth and legend, lie the answers.